Joining us to kick off the show today in studio is our friend Sean Faircloth from the Bangor City Council. Sean, welcome in on
great
this special day.
Yeah, it is. It's an important day for Martin Luther King's memory, I think.
Absolutely. And you were very involved in what looked like a remarkable ceremony last night. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it was really a fantastic ceremony. The Episcopal Church held it. It's multiple congregations get together. I think it's a tradition they've had for a little while. And I think they had people from a Congregationalist congregation as well. And it was really fantastic. And I got to say, some of the guests we had that were most remarkable was a group of folks, singers, who did sort of traditional gospel-style singing. A large portion of the singers were of African-American background. And it really got the room hopping, maybe in a way that really is distinctive for an Episcopal church. It was a great evening.
So for you, because we all, I think, we have our historical awareness of Dr. King. And yep. You're a little bit younger than me, but there's also a personal connection for many people. What is his memory and what does his work mean to you?
For me, and I tried when I spoke last night to articulate this at the Episcopal Church, is that he remains eternally relevant. And I worry, and I really sometimes get the impression that people want to put Martin Luther King in a nice, tidy, historical box and say, oh, he was that nice fellow who said, Black people shouldn't sit at the back of the bus. And we all agree with that. Round of applause. Glad we've all moved on. That was long, long ago. And so that way we can all feel like, oh, we can pat ourselves on the back and say the goals are accomplished. But when you really look at his career, he says a lot of things that are very challenging, and including things that are challenging in our current political environment. And so I think he's in some ways even more relevant today. And I'd really like us not to kind of sweep under the rug, which I think is sometimes the tendency, some of his more bold statements, particularly about economic justice issues.
Well, and let's not forget, too, that toward the end of his life, he became a bit more radical. He urged us to get out of the Vietnam War, I think, as early as 1967. He was doing in Memphis at the time, those kind of things. He stepped it up a little bit because he took some criticism from others in the African-American community, Malcolm X and others, who didn't believe he had gone far enough.
Right. I mean, Martin Luther King was never an elected official, but he constantly had political pressures on him about how he's going to react. He had Malcolm X sometimes harsh about Martin Luther King, saying he was too timid. And meanwhile, he had people on the other side. For example, you mentioned Vietnam. In 1967, it was clear from earlier conversations that Martin Luther King was opposed to the Vietnam War, but he kept those comments private for a long time. And he had people urging him, advisors saying, don't you say that. Don't you talk about that issue, because we're working on civil rights. And if you start talking about Vietnam, you're going to muddy our message and it's going to be detrimental to the cause. And he finally, you know, had a crisis of conscience about it and said, I feel like this is a justice issue, including a justice issue for African-Americans, because, frankly, disproportionately, people who were of color and people of low income tend to be the ones who are, you know, in the trenches or in the swamps of Vietnam.
Well, so here we are in the whitest state in America.
Right.
And while the population has changed a little bit, having grown up around here, I remember as a kid, back around the time of Martin Luther King, that you were perhaps likely to see more people of color around here because of Dow Air Force Base.
Right.
And the number of guys who were stationed here. And certainly we've made progress along the way, but we still have racial issues in the state of Maine. We didn't see people being lynched as they were in the South, but there is a sometimes subdued and sometimes not so subdued racial issue that still persists.
Yeah, I think so. And also, as we see new immigrants come into this state, I think there have been tensions that need to be addressed. And unfortunately, it's a reality that when you look at some of the statements we've heard at the state level and at the federal level, I think it creates a situation of tension and fear, and one that Martin Luther King would have challenged. we see too often, and I'll be blunt, since this election, I was hoping it would end with Election Day and that Donald Trump was sort of a wink and a nod with a lot of the things that he said before Election Day. But as we've seen now, a couple months in, he's saying some of the same things he's said before. He's willing to make non-factual, I guess we can put it generously, statements on a fairly regular basis, and doing things that would suppress freedom of speech. And I think that that kind of approach is something that Martin Luther King objected to and would speak out regarding, particularly as to his economic justice viewpoint. I mean, there's nothing wrong with a billionaire here or there, but to have them sort of the majority of a cabinet sort of sends a message to people.
Now, the last time you were in, we talked about your plans for a multicultural center in the area. Can you talk again about what that would do to help with the situation?
Sure. Well, I think in part, Joe Baldacci, I thank him for, I think he had an invitation to speak at the Episcopal Church as I had stepped down as mayor and he became mayor. He said, could you cover that for me? And then the minister mentioned to me that it might be good to mention the Maine Multicultural Center proposal, which we've been working on for over a year now. I haven't put a memo out in early 2016. The idea of this center would really be to actively encourage immigrants to come to our area. We need people, as businesses have clearly stated, people of working age population. We have people from the business community on our steering committee. We have people from higher education. We have people from diverse cultural groups. But really to actively seek folks out from immigrant population, because frankly we have a need for working age population in this community for economic development reasons, but also frankly to push back as well against a tenor that I think is disturbing across this country.
Well, this is a state in which the Ku Klux Klan was very prominent back in the 1920s and 30s. Used to hold parades down Wilson Street in Brewer, right. Piscataquis County. The man they backed for governor, Ralph Owen Brewster, ended up getting elected back in the 1920s. There is a history.
And was in the Senate,
That's
U.S.
Right.
Senate for a
yes.
while. Brewster was a very right-wing guy and represented Maine in ways that are I think, pretty dark. Yeah.
So what do we do as the 94 percenters here, as as Caucasian Mainers, what do we do in the meantime, in the short term, to make our neighbors feel like they're not only accepted, but a vital part of our communities, and also to feel safe?
Right. Well, I think a practical step would be something like this Maine Multicultural Center to really make that affirmative statement. And in places where similar strategies have been followed, you tend to see an increase in a population, which we need. We've had other communities. Dayton, Ohio took a strategy like this, took a tack like this, and they were losing population. They were having great difficulties, and this helped sort of stop the bleeding in terms of population loss. So it's beneficial to people in this community, regardless of what your color is. But also, I think it benefits us in terms of the type of society we want, because it's the right thing to do, first of all. But also, the young population in our society, and that includes young people in Maine, they want to live in a diverse area, and I think we are less likely to lose young people, including young people who are white, if we have that greater diversity here in the greater Bangor region. When I say, I'm talking about the large region, the area the Bangor Mall serves, to really make this area one that's known for welcoming folks.
As a parent, but also somebody who's worked close with educators for many years, do you feel like we've maybe homogenized the civil rights history in our teaching of it to students? And I see this all the time when I talk with freshmen in high school, most of whom are not aware at all that as recently as 1965 in the state of Maine, a landlord could say, no, we don't rent our apartments to blacks. Employers
right.
could say, we don't hire blacks on our job. Realtors could legally say, this is a whites-only neighborhood. I don't think our kids, sure, they know about Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and maybe Harriet Tubman, but they don't know the awful, violent story and the ugly story of our
Right, it gets simplified to a bumper sticker. Like a lot of times people ask, oh, well, there's something about a bus and you couldn't sit in the back of the bus. Mm. And certainly that is a horrible thing. But the lynchings and the fact that so much of this occurred even in places in the North and that it was legal for it to occur right. in places in the North. And it does analogize to situations with gay people. I mean, even when I was in the legislature, it was legal for a significant amount of time during my service where you could say, you're gay, you're fired, you're gay, you're evicted. Mm-hmm. You were allowed to do that. It was perfectly legal. And so these things still reached now. But the part that I spoke about last night that I think is very relevant regarding Dr. King and I think sometimes threatening to in the current political environment is that he spoke out for civil disobedience. He was saying if a law is unjust, you might disobey that law. And he pointed directly to sort of thought leaders for him, like Henry David Thoreau, who spent so much time here in Maine and in Bangor specifically, and of course, Mahatma Gandhi. And when I look at what's happening now, and the thing I called folks in the congregation last night and to your listeners is when you start to see a combination of, and this is all happening, talk about policies that would further suppress voting rights, policies that are turning back the clock on women's rights, ridiculing people who are disabled, discriminating based on religion, discriminating based on whether somebody's Mexican, or talking about John Lewis, this hero of the civil rights movement, and treating him as someone to be dismissed as we approach Martin Luther King Day. To me, that was a startling, even for Donald Trump, it was startling that you would cavalierly say something like that is astounding to me and really ominous because you would think any president, I mean, Nixon would, I'm not going to say that, but he doesn't have any such filter.
Right. Well, we want to talk more about that, too, and what we do going forward. Sean Faircloth joining us here in studio. We're going to take a quick break here. Sean Faircloth with us here in studio. And we were talking during the break when Barack Obama was elected in 2008. There were some who suggested that that was a great step forward and that we were entering a post-racial America. Well, clearly, that was not the case.
Well, yes to the first part. Was it a step forward? Yeah, I think it was a step forward, and I think he acquitted himself well. I mean, I think he did a good job as president and conducted himself with about as much dignity as I've seen in the office. But does it create a post-racial America? No, that's a bridge too far in terms of what was accomplished. But what I worry about is now, even though Hillary Clinton got almost 3 million more votes, we're faced with a situation where I think Martin Luther King and those values are especially relevant. I want to have your listeners consider that the tool of civil disobedience, which was the central tool of Martin Luther King's strategy, is something that people need to consider in this Trump era. I've said, and I mean it, that I want Donald Trump to succeed in the sense that I want him to be a good president. But I have to say, after the election day, with every appointment he's made to the cabinet, I mean, there's people that are relatively obscure because they're being overshadowed by Sessions, who has this record of racism and others. But let's take Mr. Puzder, the Secretary of Labor. I mean, this is a guy who has a combination of interesting characteristics. He says he wants to deny women's rights in the most draconian fashion, but also use them to depict them engaging in sexual activity in Carl's Jr. commercials. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a ringing Barnum and Bailey kind of approach that the circus is closed and it's moved to Washington. But what's being made a joke of is a lot of our First Amendment rights and the concern for people's civil rights. And that's an area where I think the use of civil disobedience might be appropriate. These appointees to Trump's cabinet do not bode well for basic civil liberties in this country, and we need to really look seriously about what kind of republic we want to have, because I think it's in jeopardy more than it's been since Watergate.
Now, let's play devil's advocate here and say, are we just, if Democrats choose to do that, are we just continuing the pattern of obstructionism that, the Republicans perfected over the course of the last 8 years, but Democrats also engaged in during the Bush years and going back to the Clinton years when the Republicans did the same thing, the politics of no.
So you're talking about saying no in terms of a legislative battle.
Yes.
And I guess my response to that is you just look at the merits. If Donald Trump, he says, I think somewhat somewhat spuriously and flippantly. He says he's going to have health care that's better than Obamacare for everyone. He has no explanation for how that's going to happen. But if there was some way out there that he could do that, I think Democrats should support him. They should support every good policy that he proposes. I don't have a problem with that. But when you talk about policies that are draconian, restricting women's rights, restricting voting rights, denying climate change, the guy who's making decisions for the EPA transition denies climate change, the Secretary of Energy would deny climate change, then I think it's time for us to start speaking out. Denying health care to 20 million Americans, sort of, again, almost flippantly, without much thought. This is when I think sit-ins, this is when showing up at your senator's office and showing up your member of Congress's office and saying, we're going to show up in force and organize to do so, I think among the citizenry is critically important at this time, because this is not typical. I want to say it's to the right of George W. Bush, but it's not. It's in its own chaos environment where you're not even sure what political spectrum it is.
So how best to take the legacy of Dr. King on this day, how to take that forward and combat anything that will take rights away from our fellow citizens?
These appointees, I think, are a place where people should start protesting to their members of Congress. They are not fit for the position. Senator Sessions, I mean, it's very dismaying to me. He's going to go in and sit in the chair that Robert Kennedy sat in when he proposed the Civil Rights Act. This is a guy who said racist things, wants to engage and reiterates position of things that would suppress voting rights in the South. This is incredibly disturbing. And I think people are patriots who go out and start protesting the way Martin Luther King set as an example.
And what about delegitimizing the Trump presidency? He will take the oath of office on Friday. He will be our president. Does it accomplish anything for those opposed to him and his policies to delegitimize his election?
Well, I think people should just be objective about what happened. Did Donald Trump publicly request that Mr. Putin get emails from Hillary? He did. I mean, he specifically requested that on TV. We can all watch the clip. In addition, his advisors were in contact with Mr. Putin simultaneous with when President Obama was imposing legitimate sanctions for Putin intervening in our election. Senator McCain, a very serious conservative Republican, is fully convinced, as are most other elected Republicans, that Putin did intervene. So really the only missing puzzle piece is whether there was direct communication about how and when to do this between the Trump camp and the Putin camp. And that thread has not been tied, but there are several circumstances that I've just described that make it a serious basis for investigation. And yes, if that occurred, I'm the first to say, and I agree with John Lewis in the sense that if something like that occurred, does that bring into question the legitimacy of the presidency? Yes, it does. And yes, it should be investigated, just to be objective.
All right. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.